Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
I'll say I must not hate, but I will not pretend. I saw the wreck you made of her, my herald and my friend. The scars you left in flesh and soul will be so slow to fade. Oh, would I have...
Hello and good day, everyone. Happy Tuesday, September 12th, 2017. You are listening to the Renegade Broadcasting Network. Before I get started, I would like to say Happy Truth Day, everyone. Every day should be Truth Day, by the way, but happy belated 9/11 Truth Day all the same. It's September 12th, and yesterday was September 11th. So this is going to be the obligatory 9/11 episode. I'm not sure anyone else has done one, and I'm fairly new to this, and I have a wide view of perspectives on September 11th that I would like to talk about. I've kind of been wanting to talk about it for a while, but it just wasn't appropriate, and I think today is a good day to talk about it, because let me tell you, There is so much more to September 11th than we are aware of. There is so much more to just the conspiracies, the rumors, and the truthers behind it. There is such a dynamic event that I honestly believe that September 11th is quite possibly one of the most important events in our history, in our development, more so than the Holocaust. Yes, the Holocaust was a hoax. I'm leery of nukes and that history. I'm leery of a lot of things. You know, you'll figure that out. I think most of you already know that. But when it comes to September 11th, I'm not sure there's been any event in recent history that has had so much thought put into it. My suspicion is that this event had been premeditated or rather considered for a lot longer than we think. I suspect that maybe 9/11 may have been 100 years in the making. Something's a lot more premeditated than just a spur-of-the-moment kind of, the towers are not making any money, we better do it, and we'll just rush into a war. That sounds too short-sighted for me. I think there was a lot more consideration put into it. But first off, I'm jumping ahead of myself here. I want to talk about some things going on here and talk about what's happening and maybe reference last week a little bit because there's something I left untouched. But first off, this is, yes, you are tuning into Westworld. I always forget that. I forget the name of the show. I'm always jumping ahead. I'm a little scatterbrained. So last week, if you recall, I mentioned that I wasn't feeling too good. All right. So for myself, I get migraines from time to time, not too often, but sometimes I get headaches. I mean, like once a year, I get afflicted with it for a couple days and I'm feeling you get uncomfortable. You can tell the difference between a migraine and a headache because typically a migraine, you're light sensitive, you're auditory sensitive, you're just not in the good mood. You're feeling kind of crummy, to say the least. I don't get migraines too bad. One time, like 4 years ago, I got a migraine. It was absolutely terrible. I just couldn't sleep, couldn't do anything. I was like twitching. It was painful. But typically, you know, when migraines occur, you know, people like to take aspirin. I think aspirin is a medicine that you can use to help nullify the effects. But for myself, I realized that coffee dulls the pain. Actually, I think coffee actually does away with the pain of migraines entirely. So that's actually the medicine that I use when I'm not feeling too good. That may be kind of why I prefaced staying up late or not getting a whole lot of sleep, because I'll drink coffee and it works for a few hours. And strangely enough, this was a medicine or remedy that was taught to me by my uncle, who also got migraines, and he told me that's what he has to help nullify the pain a little bit. So I'm slightly curious. Does that work for other people as well? Like, if you get like a migraine, if you get a headache or something, does coffee make the does coffee nullify the pain a bit? It works for me. It works for my uncle. I'm not sure if it works for others. And you know, if you're the kind of person who doesn't like taking medicine, and I agree with you, I think you should try to eliminate as much medicine as possible from your diet. I don't think you should be having aspirin or Tylenol or any of these other painkillers, because they're so concentrated. They get themselves into your livers and kidneys, it's a real shock on your system to have such concentrated medicines. I'm not an engineer, and I don't a chemical engineer, and I don't look at the back of the bottles. I don't know what the active ingredient is. You'll have to forgive me. I just know that it's tough on your body. It makes you feel better, but I'm not sure it's good for your organs and whatnot. But for myself, coffee seems to do the trick, and luckily for me, the next day I was feeling a lot better than I was yesterday or the day before that. So hey, that's great. So, you know, give that a shot. And if you're the kind of person who gets migraines, have a cup of coffee and see if it works. I mean, it works for me. It works for my uncle. Maybe it just works for me. Maybe it's a placebo effect or something. Don't know. But I find it effective. However, I understand that, you know, we're a society that's addicted to a lot of things. You know, we're addicted to alcohol, pleasure, coffee, caffeine rather, sugar. We have a lot of addictions in our modern world which aren't healthy for us, but I do think that there probably is a benefit to some of these things in small supplies or in moderation. So that's something about yesterday. And I was thinking about it. I said, you know, I should mention this, because if you can use coffee to dull the pain of a headache or something, maybe that's better than, say, taking Tylenol or aspirin or something. Alrighty. That's that. I would like to preface something. This is not so much a shout out, because I have a tendency of performing shout outs. Like, hey, I'm going to shout out this guy. Like last week I did John Smith, and John Smith is with us today. He's helping to facilitate this show because Kyle doesn't have internet where he's at. So John Smith is helping us. Thank you, John Smith, for, I don't know what your position is called. I don't know what you, for facilitating this show. I appreciate that. I'm sure the listeners appreciate that as well. However, I would like to give a special acknowledgement to Davis Lerman. Davis Lerman, I think some people may find his behavior a little crass. I've seen that in the comment sections. However, ignoring that, there's aspects to Davis Lerman I actually really like. I appreciate Davis Lerman's old school approach to problems, to addressing the world that we live in. He's got this kind of boots on the ground type of attitude where he seems to focus a little less on conjecture and focuses more on getting first hand accounts and examining the evidence. And that's the type of behavior you see in the old school audience. You know, I mean, you can think of what you want of people like William Cooper or others. we'll say others, but they came from a different time in which all you really had was, you know, you had to do the work. You had to go around. You had to go to the libraries. You had to dig up information. And it's so much that type of attitude that, you know, doing the hard work is something that's a little bit more telling to someone's character than our modern times, where all someone has to do is go on to YouTube and you'll find all the Drake videos that you want of just endless conjecture and opinions. And before you know it, you have people thinking that they're an expert on something. Oh, I saw a video on this. I saw a video on that. It must be true. Now, I'll agree that, you know, I've learned a lot from YouTube. You know, I think a lot of people coming up end up using YouTube probably more so than they should, but it's because it's such an easy site to navigate. You know, the problem with the internet, of course, is you got to know what you're looking for in order to find it. But in general, YouTube allows you to quickly find stuff and, you know, a link. Oh, here's a link to this. If you like this, you like that. I understand the whole thing about shadow banning and finding popular videos. I mean, they intentionally try to push videos on you, but in general, it's easier to find those type of stuff. But like I said, it creates that environment where someone can walk in believing that they're an expert or that they're well-informed, even though they've never really done anything. They're just watching these videos saying, oh, they're allowing other people to think for them. And they might even bring up good or credible evidence to some extent, but it's very, very easy for conjecture. In general, what I've found in humans is that we are more imaginative than scientific. In general, people like to speculate a lot more than we do like to look at the evidence. It takes a very exceptional person to go with the evidence, watch it, and then allow the evidence to speak for itself, drawing your conclusions from what is in front of you. Because speculation is very easy to do. And Davis Lerman has mentioned this before about firsthand accounts and making sure you get things correct. And that's very admirable. That's a very admirable approach to trying to discover or unravel the truth, trying to get to the bottom of things. I respect that. I really respect that type of behavior. And that's something that we're missing in a lot of the young bloods out there that jump towards more opinionated ideas without actually examining evidence. And of course, we all get things wrong. We're all, in essence, we're all to some degree stumbling in the dark, trying to get out. We're trying to figure things out. So, you know, and that's the nature of activism in a sense. You know, we want to do what is right. Most humans generally want to do what's correct. But we will say things that are incorrect. I've said things that are incorrect. Of course I have. I've perpetuated untruths. I can't say that it was a lie necessarily. I wasn't intending on lying, but I've said things that are untrue because I thought they were true. You know, as for myself, I used to think that the Nazis were crypto Jews and that everything about the National Socialist was a Jewish plot to destroy Germany. I perpetuated that. I've told people that. And believe me, I was wrong. I was absolutely wrong because I listened to some people like Christopher John Bjerknes, who perpetuate these ideas, and Daryl Bradford Smith of the French Connection. And I don't believe these people were wrong. I don't believe that they were intentionally trying to be misleading. I just think that was the information they had at the time, and it seems to fit into some sort of narrative that they have. I don't think that any of these people were trying to be misleading. However, I think the book, The Pink Triangle, or no, it was The Pink Swastika, where this one crackpot author thought that that Hitler and the National Socialists were a bunch of homosexuals, and that the that and that that would explain their violent tendencies or the alleged violent tendencies. That's a big crock of doo doo. That's absolutely laughable when you think about that one. This idea that Hitler would go around the gay bars recruiting gay men, and then they would end up forming, you know, the National Socialists because only homosexuals are that violent. I mean, hey man, let me tell you, homosexuals can be incredibly violent. Oh, absolutely, they can be. They can be very, you know, that stereotype that they're these limp-wristed ladyboys is only half true. Some of them are like that, no doubt. And they're the ones that we all know about, or that's the common stereotype. There are other homosexuals that are very militant, very... mean? Not quite the word, but that are very, very not like that. They are not like that type of aggressive. Maybe that's a better word. Aggressive. They are very aggressive and arguably even militant in their beliefs. But yes, I suppose what I'm saying is in the journey to try to find truth, trying to get that catharsis, we are on this path, and we can make mistakes, and we make mistakes, and that's the thing that we have to get over to some degree. We have to get over that and actually that's a testimony to bravery, in my opinion. It's a very brave person to stand out against the crowd, against groupthink, and try and inform them or tell them that they're wrong. You know, that is a very difficult thing to do, which is a testimony of character. But like I said, you will eventually make mistakes. I've made mistakes. You will say things that are untrue, but the strength in that comes from acknowledging when you've made a mistake, that, you know, it comes from admitting that you are not correct. Which I have done that before, and you know what? I've done that most of my life, so that was never really a hard thing for me to do. To say, well, you know what? I was wrong. I was incorrect. Because typically, ego gets in the way. It gets in the way for a lot of people, because I think a lot of people in our modern world don't seldom ever have to admit when they're wrong. But as for myself, I've done that most of my life. Not just in telling the truth, but just in any sort of affairs. You know, I valued myself on being an honest person. I always wanted to do what is correct. But that is the hurdle that many of us must overcome when trying to communicate to other people, and that is sometimes we'll make mistakes. You know, that attitude of wanting to be a perfectionist is very difficult to get over. You know, you want to look into something and you want to make sure you got everything correct so you don't make a mistake. Because I was a perfectionist in a lot of ways, but eventually you must come to the understanding that it's impossible to know everything. It simply is. You can try to understand as much as you can, and I always encourage everyone to learn something new and learn as much as you can. I'm always trying to learn as much as I can. But unfortunately, absolute knowledge is unobtainable, and a time will come when you must act. You must do something. You can't sit there and study your entire life to be correct or to be 100% correct, to be infallible. Do your best, but that's impossible. And I believe that is the fear that some people have, you know, that hurdle of overcoming of admitting your shortcomings, admitting that you were incorrect on something. But like I said, it's a true testimony to character, to a person who can acknowledge that. It's absolutely fantastic. So take a little drink of water. So, and of course, I'm prefacing this because I want to talk about September 11th. Because there's been a lot of conjecture in September 11th, and I've definitely said things that I believe are untrue, and I've come to conclusions which I believe are true, and I believe that following the evidence is what's important. Now, of course, if you're an observant person, you probably already understand where I'm going towards. So I have the book right here. For many of you, I think maybe how the towers were destroyed maybe aren't quite as important as who did it. I can understand that line of reasoning. We can definitely examine the Zionist agenda within September 11th, and there most certainly was. There was a very Jewish handprint in September 11th with people within our government, the half-Israeli, half-American people, the PNAC, the Project for New American Century. I would say, if anything, there was only one racial group that benefited directly from September 11th, and that was the Jews. The only racial group, I think we can all say uncontestedly, they benefited from this. However, there were plenty of other people that benefited from this as well. And, you know, some of them are non-Jews. But like I said, the only racial group, to my understanding, who benefited entirely were the Jews. But to me, when I tried to figure out what happened with September 11th, and I was a latecomer to this, I was a latecomer to most things, I fell into September 11th because I studied false flags. That was kind of the direction from which I came from. In fact, it's been many years, over 2 years now, and I can't actually recall what was the catalyzing event which started me off on this journey, and I think it was false flag events, I think, helped get me on this path. It wasn't Sandy Hook, because I can remember that I wasn't even aware. I remember someone joking about, it was actually my brother, made a joke about Sandy Hook, and I didn't even know what it was. I was like, what the hell is Sandy Hook? I'm not sure I'm getting the joke here. And he told me about this, you know, school in which some children died. And even then, I didn't really look into it. But it was something about false flags that started me off on this journey, which eventually, after, you know, how fortuitous that a couple of my friends joked about September 11th and how jet fuel can't melt steel beams. And I think it was several weeks before that I joked, I was joking with him, like, oh yeah, I know. The jet fuel doesn't have to melt the steel beams, it just has to weaken the structure of the building in order for it to collapse. I remember, and that was like several weeks before I actually really examined September 11th, and then that's when I became a batshit crazy conspiracy theorist to some. But it is interesting that I do recall that. When I mentioned to one of my brothers, I have multiple brothers, where I mentioned to one of my brothers, because I have one brother who's been on the same journey as me, and I have another brother who thinks I'm absolutely crazy. But for my other brother, who's actually my twin brother, we started this journey together, and we've been helping each other out. We have slightly different interests in where we go from. The things that he likes to look into versus the things I like to look into are different, but we see eye to eye on most everything. We're like, okay, we see where we're coming from. I eventually fell into the National Socialist spectrum of things, and my twin brother fell into more of the near-death experience, ghosts, spirituality area. That's more or less where he likes to dwell. And believe me, there's some very interesting things in that spectrum. He's very thoughtful. In fact, I would argue that it was my twin brother who taught me how to see the world differently. He was the one who exposed to me different types of thinking. He was more adventurous in the mind than I was. I was a little bit more arguably close-minded. But remember, I passed that a comment off to him about joking about September 11th. And I said, yeah, it didn't really happen. And he said one thing to me that set me off. And he said, well, I don't know about that. Just that one little sentence. Well, I don't know about that. Or I'm not sure. I don't really know. Those words set me off to say, huh. Well, if my brother is uncertain of September 11th and he doesn't think that that the mainstream story is correct, then I should look into it. And ultimately, we both end up looking into it. And boy, was that a journey. Was that an adventure? You know, coming from behind the eight ball, there has already been a lot of people that had looked into September 11th, and there had been a lot of stories about it. And I think I followed a progressive path where I think maybe I started off with the stand down order. We had the September clues, the loose change was some of the first things that I ended up watching. You know, really interesting stuff. But knowing me, I don't stop there. I want to keep going. I don't want to stop with just one little thing there. I want to know more. I want to figure out more. So beyond the loose change, I found an interesting person named Mark Passio, who examined the occult aspect of September 11th, which I thought was very interesting. I would like to do more comments on Mark Passio because I'm not sure how trustworthy of a person he really is. But he does have some interesting occult views. But after watching many of his videos, I've become a little leery of his perspectives. Or definitely, I can give you an analysis of the type of character that he is. Because one thing that I really... Oh boy, Passio. Yes, Mark Passio. I suspect that a few people know of him or about him. And I have an interesting analysis of his character, or I've been able to compile an interesting analysis of his character. But at the time, it was a great introduction to the occult world. I didn't know anything about the occult, so that was an introduction to it, in which I was able to do more and more of my own research to discover things. And I there's some things about 9/11 that are really strange in the occult world that I will share with you. Some things that very few people mention. And, you know, and in that journey, I was like, oh my God, what's going on with September 11th? And then I started entering into the more conspiracy spectrum where it was like, oh, there was no airplanes at all. There was the controlled demolition story. It was the bombs. It was the mini nuke. It was, and for a little time, I was like, it was the nanomachines, because after looking at the tower, I did realize that the tower was turning to dust. I did see that. I was examining it multiple times over. I realized that this was not just a... we were not being told the full clue, which eventually, at the very end of the road, led me to Dr. Judy Wood. I'm sure a few of you know of her name, and I'm sure few, even less of you have actually read her book, which I own her book right here. Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. To be frank, I fell in love with Dr. Wood because I believe she was absolutely correct in her analysis. I think the evidence she provides is fantastic, and I appraise her scientific mind in the analysis of September 11th. And so, for this, I will be talking about Dr. Judy Wood, the woman who truly showed me how to examine evidence, and this woman, who was there almost from the start, has been ostracized, demonized, and rejected by the so-called truth movement, just because she did what nobody else did, and that was she looked at the evidence. And I believe that's absolutely true. I believe that Dr. Judy Wood was closer to the truth than anyone else, and that is why they had to reject her. I think there was bravado got involved in the way. I think people like Stephen Jones, one of the pioneers of the nanothermite myth. Yes, I'm going so far as to call it a myth. I don't think it's accurate. I think he was challenged because Dr. Judy Wood had more degrees under her belt. She had more papers under her belt. She had the credentials. She was a structural engineer. She understands applied physics. And many of these other people in the truther community don't. They're not nearly as educated as Dr. Wood is. And I think maybe that was a threat, or at least a threat to them. I think they were looking for their own glory, their own interest in this. But like I said, when examining, I did notice that when you see the towers coming down, it looks pretty obvious to me that the tower is turning into dust. Oh, by the way, warnings. I suppose this might trigger some people, but we'll just go with that. This may be controversial, and maybe some of you people don't agree with it. Maybe you don't like the directed energy narrative. However, I believe it to be absolutely factual, or I believe it to be much closer to the truth than not. Like I said, there was a short time before I found Judy Wood that examining it, I was like, wow, there's something really strange going on here. It looks like the tower is literally turning into dust as it's falling. And I thought it was like nanomachines, you know. That was just my own random idea. Just like, wow, there must be something happening on a molecular level where they're tearing it apart. Well, that's a little silly, a little sci-fi-ish. But at the time, I thought it made sense. But yes, Dr. Judy Wood, her general belief is that some sort of directed energy weapon was used against the World Trade Towers, which destroyed the molecular bonds of the steel, primarily the steel within the towers, and broke it down into its smallest elements, which manifested in nanoparticulates of dust. That is effectively her belief. And I would say, examining the evidence, it looks pretty compelling that that's probably what occurred. The issue that I've taken with the controlled demolition theory is that I'm puzzled by it. After taking enough time examining the controlled demolition story, I wanted to ask the question, how were the logistics done? How was the entire tower rigged with explosives? It's a fair question to ask. How was it done? The towers didn't explode. Obviously they didn't. You can watch the footage. It doesn't have the hallmark sounds of a controlled demolition. You know, the boom, 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 boom. There's eyewitnesses, certainly. There are eyewitnesses there that said they heard explosions. But the footage that I've seen doesn't indicate that there was the sounds of sequential explosions. There was a noise as the tower fell, seemingly. But I guess what I'm saying is we cannot rely solely on eyewitness accounts, or they may be interpreting things that may be inaccurate, I suppose is what I'm saying. I do like eyewitness accounts. I'm not discrediting them. I am simply stating that the eyewitness account or their interpretation of the event may not be accurate to what's really occurring. I guess that's what I'm saying about the eyewitness accounts of the firemen that were there present, because they have been used a lot, these firemen, to substantiate or confirm this idea of a controlled demolition narrative. because we generally like to use eyewitnesses or firsthand accounts. I know that I remember when I'm watching Loose Change and others, they will use these firsthand accounts. But like I said, it could be they may not be accurate to what's really occurring, because the major problem that we have is, first and foremost, once the towers fell, where was the debris? That's a really interesting question to address. I think maybe if you address anyone. In fact, I think I do recall my father asking the very same question once the tower seemingly fell. Where did the debris go? Where did the debris of these towers go? Because there was over 500,000 tons of material came crashing down, or should have. In theory, 500,000 tons of material should have came down. But I'm not seeing piles and piles of debris. Most of the photographic evidence that I see, and at least what Judy Wood addresses, shows arguably very little evidence that 500,000 tons of material made it towards the ground level. Now, of course, there's people like Rudy Giuliani and others that try to address that, that the cleanup started immediately. Now, first and foremost, we can acknowledge that that would be a crime. That would be a crime if someone cleaned up the crime scene before anything was done. I mean, we can all agree with that. However, to me and to Dr. Wood, it looks like a cover story for the fact that not enough debris fell. The story that, well, we got all these vehicles out here and we hauled away all this material overnight, and that they were working, and that effectively they worked day and night to remove all the crash materials, and that's why some people say, well, that's why there wasn't a lot of materials, because they got started on the removal right away, and then we shipped out all the steel to China. There's that story as well. However, Judy Wood, and myself included, believe that these sound like cover stories for the simple fact that there wasn't enough material that hit the ground. Again, it's just looking at the ground zero, there just doesn't look like there's 500 tons of material, and that's each tower. Each tower is 500 tons of material on the ground. It just, in fact, in a lot of places, you can see it's practically at ground level. Stranger than that is, of course, the odd holes that formed on towers, excuse me, on building, what is it? My notes are all scattered and they're all over the place. But we have of course, the strange holes appearing in World Trade Center 6. Building number 6 had the massive hole through it, which people claim that debris fell on top of it. Well, the problem is that where's the debris? If a large piece of debris fell onto building number 6, we should see debris within the large hole of 6, and simply there just doesn't look like there's a lot of debris. It looks like it was simply bored out. This is unprecedented, in my opinion. And in the comments section, we have Shauna C. She mentioned something very appropriately. She mentioned that no floors theory. I don't know about the no floors theory. I thought she mentioned flood. Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't reading too properly, but I guess I can get to that as well. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I understand what the no floor theory is. I've heard a lot of really strange ideas. Like, some people think that the towers were hollowed out and filled with dust, and then they were exploded or something like that. You know, some pretty crazy ideas, I think. And obviously, there were people inside the building. There were people that were calling. And they were, you know, there really were people inside. However, another problem that Dr. Wood has brought up in her arguments is that, and this is a very good argument, that these towers and that this facility was built in Lower Manhattan. It's okay, Shauna. It's fine. It's my fault. I was misreading. The problem with it is that Lower Manhattan was built below the water table, and it was built within what Dr. Judy Wood called the bathtub. in which there was a retaining wall that was keeping the water out from flooding lower Manhattan. It's safe to think that if these two massive towers, each of them weighing 500,000 tons, that they would have damaged the subfloor, the bathtub in which the towers were built, because they were built below sea level. But surprisingly, this wasn't the case. There wasn't enough structural damage caused to the basement levels of the tower, which that amount of impact should have broken the bathtub and flooded the area, which simply did not occur. That is very strange. In fact, there are photographs that confirm that the basement floors or the underground parking garage of the towers weren't even damaged. Well, they were damaged a little bit, but not too badly, which would indicate that most of the damage, or that there was very little damage caused below ground on the lower section of the towers after they supposedly fell. Which, again, that is a pretty big mystery. I will not coming off a little bit too scattered brain. I had a lot of, I've been a little busy lately, and I was like, I want to do a show on this. I want to talk about this, but it's so big, I don't know how to do it. So I'm going to try to run through this as fast, or in many sections, so we don't dwell on too many topics. Because like I said, there's a lot we got to talk about. Yes, Shauna C, absolutely correct. I was going to mention that, and I will, and because you brought it up, I will bring it up as well. Dr. Judy Wood also brought up the fact that there was a hurricane that went straight to Manhattan for several days. It was, open it up to page 400, because that's where the hurricane is, and that was Hurricane Erin. And this is why Judy Wood brought it up, by the way, because it's very, I've listened to a lot of Dr. Judy Wood's interviews. She's been interviewed by quite a few people, and typically she likes to stick to the evidence, but you'll get more information from her interviews asking her to provide a little bit of conjecture. She doesn't like to do that. She avoids that as much as possible, conjecture. But she will address some issues if it's brought up, and in these interviews she will bring it up. So Hurricane Erin was a Category 2 hurricane that made its way to Manhattan. In fact, it started off near Florida, and for nearly a week, it made a straight line straight to New York. Now, Dr. Wood is not professing that this hurricane had anything to do with the event. Simply put, she does not know. She's simply addressing the hurricane as just weird. But the thing about the hurricane, because people have asked Dr. Wood about the hurricane, do you think this had something to do with the field effect theory that you talk about, that in order to manipulate elements, to manipulate steel and other components, from Judy Wood, which she learned from a interesting gentleman called Dr. Hutchinson. See, I just call him Dr. Hutchinson. I'm not sure if he's a doctor, but he lives in Oregon now, but he's called John Hutchinson, in which this incredibly interesting person was able to recreate similar effects from what Judy Wood saw on September 11th. And Mr. Hutchinson was able to mimic these effects by creating a field effect, which is a static field, and then he would use microwaves and radio waves, and he would bombard certain elements at different frequencies, at different location, at different angles, and he would produce very strange effects. Some people think that John Hutchinson is a con artist and that he's a fraud. You can find his videos on YouTube. However, Mr. Hutchinson has been interviewed by multiple people. Judy Wood has met with him personally, and she testifies that it's all legit. I personally think Mr. Hutchinson is legit, but people are very leery of Hutchinson. They think he's a liar simply because Mr. Hutchinson cannot properly explain how he performs his tasks. Like, you know, he'll take like a large piece of steel and he'll effectively like turn it to dust. He'll cause it to shrink like a shrinky dink, and it will start emitting weird smoke, some form of dust, which Dr. Wood believes that similar effects were seen on September 11th, the steel of the World Trade Center towers. But it is because Mr. Hutchinson cannot properly explain his science that people think he's a fraud. And I would say that's very misleading, because not everyone fully understands what they do. See, Mr. Hutchinson explains that he simply is performing things that feel correct. He just works by feel. He doesn't fully understand the science behind his research. He just goes with what he understands. And there's actually a parallel with that with Nikola Tesla. For I understand that Nikola Tesla also discovered X-rays along the same time another gentleman discovered X-rays. However, Nikola Tesla didn't understand the science behind X-rays. He just understood that the machine he built could do it. But he didn't understand why it was the way that it was. So what I'm saying is that people can discover things, but they may not have a scientific mind for things. Which to me, I think is fascinating. And it doesn't mean that a person is unintelligent or can't do something. But when Judy Wood was asked about this hurricane, do you think this hurricane had something to do with a field effect that occurred over Manhattan to destroy the towers in some sort of directed energy event? She is uncertain. She simply just does not want to answer that. She just thinks it's weird. But it is absolutely fascinating. However, the real thought that Judy Wood has about the hurricane is that simply there wasn't enough news coverage of this hurricane, because Manhattan is pretty much at ocean level. And the true problem with this hurricane is that if the hurricane made contact with Manhattan, there would have been major flooding in Manhattan. Absolutely, there would have been. And so she's curious as to why no one really covered it. And I would contend it's probably because September 11th, or this terrorist attack, was probably premeditated, and they didn't want to cover this hurricane event. People ask, was this hurricane directed? Judy Wood does not want to answer on that because she's not interested in conjecture. It's simply odd. I hope I'm not coming off as a little strange here. So yeah, that's definitely a strange thing. And of course, I was actually with my uncle. You know, when I was coming around with this, I met with my uncle. And I was compelled. I just had to tell him these things about September 11th that are seldom acknowledged. I remember telling him about the toasty cars, which has kind of been which is a really big thing to Dr. Wood, talking about the weird burnt looking toasted cars, which a lot of people have tried to explain why these cars have gotten toasty. And if you're not familiar with it, check it out. Check out the toasty cars. So I was trying to explain that to my uncle, and he freaked out. He just was like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. There's pandemonium everywhere. There's burning debris falling down. Who knows what happened? It's just like, I don't think that can explain everything about the unusual effects of the toasted cars that are well documented in photographs by news media men and others. Though one of the popular counter arguments to the toasted cars is the chiropractic flow effect that has been perpetuated by certain people that believe in the controlled demolition narrative of the thermite, where they believe that the large dust cloud that blew out was perhaps hot, and that it burnt away some of the first layers of the cars or something like that. However, the pyroclastic flow idea doesn't really make sense, because there are people that were caught up in the dust and they didn't get burned. And because of that, the story that the pyroclastic flow idea does not come off as a very feasible idea. Oh, guys, I'm reading a comment here. Thanks for the info. Yeah, I understand. September 11th, it may not be a very fascinating idea because it's so old, but I find it interesting. So yes, the weird pyroclastic flow, the toasted cars, is a very unusual bit of evidence, very strange to say the least. However, there's a lot more to September 11th than we are fully aware of. Strange things are happening all over the place. However, there are some people that I've come across when examining September 11th that pulled up some very interesting information on their own, which I would like to share with you. There's a gentleman that I came across, and his name was Richard D. Hall, and he has a website called Rich Planet TV. And Richard Hall is one of these old schoolers that I mentioned earlier that I was prefacing. He's this Englishman who covers false flags in England. He has an old school attitude where he's interested, you know, he's interested in like the alien question, UFOs, cover ups, and all that other good stuff. He encompasses everything within that the old school feeling. That old school investigator, where he has actually gone on foot to locations in England to uncover false flags because he wants firsthand accounts. He really tries to expose things for what they are. And I've been a follower of Richard Hall for many years now, and I appreciate him. He was actually had 1 year hiatus, and I was kind of disappointed. I thought maybe he was going to be gone for good, but eventually he came back. He came back not just a few months ago. Which made me happy. He brought up the recent terrorist events that occurred in England, or these false flag events, as he believes them to be. However, Richard also was fascinated by September 11th, and he became friends with Dr. Wood, and he has interviewed her several times on his shows. Now, Richard Hall is an investigator in his own right, and he was very curious about the no planes or airplane theory. Were there airplanes that hit the towers? Were there no airplanes that hit the towers? Now, in Judy Wood's perspective, she simply states, and it's very great. Judy Wood says, real airplanes could not have caused the towers to collapse. Neither could fake airplanes. Judy Wood does not wish to go any further in that line of thought about September 11th. However, Mr. Hall, on the other hand, wanted to figure out if the flights of the planes were accurate. Because I remember when I was researching it, I remember talking about how strange the flights were. You know, when you examine the flights, you have the dive bomber footage, you have the Fox Chopper 5 footage where it looks like the planes just go straight into the towers or whatnot. But it's very, very strange. And I remember that I used to talk about that one, about the odd plane footage. But Richard, you used GPS. He aligned the footages where the alleged people shot the airplanes. He recreated the Twin Towers on a CG model, and then he used the flight trajectory provided by the government and the, or I think it was a civilian in the military, and he overlaid them together, and then he examined over 40 plane flights of the footage, and Richard Hall concluded that there was no discrepancies in any of the footages. All footage of the airplanes are correct. They are accurate. There is no discrepancy between any of the footages, not the dive bomb, not all of them are accurate. So I wish to explain that one. If you ever end up in a conversation with someone, and I understand September 11th is one of those things where it's like, you know, I have friends that talk about September 11th, or if I try to mention the weird things that occurred, the common response is, well, it's just not culturally relevant anymore. I don't see why we should talk about it. You know, and I understand for the average person, September 11th doesn't seem that interesting. It's a little dated for their tastes. However, 9/11 is not over yet. This is not done yet. This was the event that was supposed to kickstart their New World Order agenda. It's a part of their globalization plan. This was a very significant event, and things are still happening. We're still living with the repercussions of September 11th. And for that reason, it's still significant, despite the fact that many people in outside of the conspiracy realm just don't think it's very important. It still very much is. And that's how these people get away with things. They perpetrate these acts, and then they want you to think they're not very important, even though they're very important. They planned it for, again, my analysis would say that they had been planning this event for at least 40 years. I suspect probably closer to 100 years. So this was huge to them. And I'll explain that in astrotheology, because you remember, I talk about astrotheology because it's a very interesting thing. Well, September 11th lined up with certain astrological events that are irrefutable that show that there is an occult agenda behind this. Absolutely there is, and it connects to Saturn, it connects to Freemasonry, it connects to Kabbalah, it connects with all of these things, and that's why September 11th, to me, is still significant. It is so fascinating. But yes, Mr. Hall, and I found that fascinating, that Mr. Hall was able to conclude that there's no discrepancy with the flights, but just because of that, Mr. Hall still does not believe in the airplanes. Mr. Hall came from the approach that he did not believe that there were any airplanes in September 11th. He actually now leans more towards the idea of a hologram that collided with the towers. I am in the same camp. I don't necessarily believe that there were airplanes. I'm not in that. I for the longest time, I thought that they were video fakery, because I saw the videos of a gentleman named Ace Baker, and I'm sure many of you have heard of Ace Baker, which I will pick up on the other side of the break.
Sobbing out for a few shekels, then dividing up my robes, they sold me out. It's the oldest story that's ever been told, they sold me out. Didn't even give an old shred about, no, they sold me out. Didn't even sit down and try to figure it out. They just sold me out for a few shekels more. Didn't even think twice for a few shekels more. Another minute in the spotlight.
Here's Jewish professor Noel Ignatieff.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
We'll be right back.
All right, we are back. Thank you very much. Back from the break, top of the hour, top of the second hour, actually. And I was reading a couple of the comments, and I have to say, don't worry. You believe me, I'm not offended by anything you say. I'm a very hard person to offend, and I, like I said, I understand this show feel this conversation I'm having seems a little bit scattered. I really wanted to talk about this topic. I just didn't have a whole lot of time to set up notes or rehearse anything. So I apologize in advance that I'm coming off as a little weird or a little all over the place. Not my best show, I can admit. And there'll probably be a lot more shows like this where I seem like I'm just coming off a little weird. Or I'm coming off as a little scattered. So, but hey, don't worry about it. I'm not bothered by anything. All you lovely people in the chat room, I don't get offended. I'm very hard to offend. I have a pretty thick skin. I have sensibilities about myself. But I think just before that break, I mentioned this interesting little character called Ace Baker. He was a guy who did a nice little series of videos. I think his YouTube video was called Peace and Anarchy, in which he tried to make the argument that the airplanes were live video composites. And when I first saw that, I was very impressed. I thought his videos were very good. And I think there's still some good information that you can take from his videos. However, don't bring up Ace Baker in any conversations. Don't try to use him as a tool or instrument if you're talking to other people and you want to promote the idea that there were no airplanes, which I do not believe there were any. And I'll tell you why. Because Ace Baker discredited himself. He made himself look like an ass in an interview that he was having who's that guy that he's one of these truthers that's been around for a while. He has a very insufferable attitude. I think I wrote his name somewhere. Very, very well-known character. I apologize. I forgot his name because he's so unmemorable. But Ace Baker faked his own death over an interview. And afterwards, he professed that it was creative liberties or that he was just acting in theatrics. If anyone was ever to follow up with Ace Baker, that's probably what they'll catch on, and you'll discredit yourself because the last thing you want to do is try to mention people that fly off the rails or act really, really strange. And I was very disappointed when I had figured that out about this gentleman named Ace Baker, that he would be the kind of person willing to fake his own death over an interview just for attention. That's very, very disappointing. Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. It was his art. That's what he called it. You know, if you're going to behave that way over an interview, I mean, that's absurd. That's absurd that anyone would act that way. And you do. You discredit everything you do if that's how you're going to behave. Very disappointing. So you've probably all heard of him. Maybe you didn't know that aspect of Ace Baker that he did that long ago, but that's why. That's why no one listens to him. Yes, go ahead. You can find the interview. He even fakes the gun. He even fakes the bang noise too. It's just like it's absurd. It was ridiculous that he would do it. Why anyone would discredit themselves? Well, I guess he just wasn't serious. He was, God damn it. What was the name of that guy? What was the name of that fool? I mean, he's such an iconic person, and he's so uncomfortable. I don't like him. Jenkins. I'm sorry, everyone. I just don't remember his name. But yeah, that's Ace Baker for you. Let's give a round of applause for Ace Baker. It was great of him to do something like that. And I say that because it's very likely that you're a person that would come across his research, but don't know about that other side of him, which I had to learn on the hard. I learned on the hard way. It's like, oh, this guy acts like a total nut. Now, I've been talking I guess I've been rambling on a lot about September 11th, perhaps incoherently, just trying to support Dr. Wood on her theory of directed energy that effectively tore the powers apart at a molecular level. Sounds far-fetched, but in many ways, I agree with Dr. Wood that the largest reason why people don't really want to consider this is because the implications are too frightening for most people. I totally understand that, because when I came across it, believe me, I lost sleep. There was a night where I didn't even sleep. I was so frightened by that, I couldn't sleep. And I was, in a way, I was actually relieved in one of the interviews I was listening to Dr. Wood, where when she brought this up with a former colleague of hers, that he relayed to her, it was, thank you, everyone. I'm having a real conversation with the people in the chat room. I guess I'm not taking this too seriously, but Shaughnessy brought it up perfectly. Jim Fetzer, thank you. Jim Fetzer, that's the guy. Thank you, Shaughnessy. You're on it. Jim Fetzer. Yeah, Jim Fetzer. Let me bring something up real quick with Jim Fetzer. I'm very disappointed with Jim Fetzer, because early on, when the truth movement was getting established, Dr. Wood was on the in crowd. She was friends with Stephen E. Jones, Jim Fetzer, and these other notable names. However, what eventually happened was Fetzer turned on Judy Wood. In fact, everyone eventually turned on Judy Wood, and they pretty much exiled her, and everyone just started calling her a loony. And Dr. Wood claims that Jim Fetzer personally threatened her. And in some interviews, we can see that Fetzer acts very rude to Dr. Wood, which is strange, because early on, Fetzer gushed over Judy Wood. He professed that she was amazing and that she was a great person. And Fetzer openly talked about directed energy as an actual tool or implement. Most people are already aware with the Donald Rumsfeld directed energy question. You know, Donald Rumsfeld was being interviewed by the press, and he was asked about directed energy, and Donald Rumsfeld acted very, well, actually stuttered and seemed a little bit nervous about it. Well, however, Jim Fetzer, early on, like I said, openly discussed the concept of directed energy. He was talking about these rumors and stories of directed energy weapons being used against Iraqis and Afghanis in the war on terror, which I have heard independent of Jim Fetzer. It's very interesting that a person like Jim Fetzer would start off promoting Judy Wood, and then he would eventually turn on her and become very rude and very critical of her research. You know, it's one of these things where it seems like people like to turn on people. That's the thing. That's the bad blood between Jim Fetzer and Judy Wood. There is definitely bad blood between them, and that's why. Just so you know, I mean, it's very interesting, to say the least. And in my opinion, it raises the question of Jim Fetzer and where his true allegiances lie. I think, in general, I don't really like Jim Fetzer, to be frank. I don't like really anything Jim Fetzer brings up. He talks about a lot of things. In general, I just don't like Jim Fetzer. Yeah, thank you, Shaughnessy. Yes, he makes your skin crawl. I mean, he looks like a slug in a man suit, if you ask me. I don't know where this guy came from. And he's a philosophy major, too. That's like he majors in philosophy, and yet he's here in the truth movement as some sort of significant figure. And it's fine. You can have a degree in philosophy or whatever, but I'm simply saying that in the scientific realm, he's nowhere near the same level as Dr. Wood. Okay. Because Shaughnessy brought up Jim Fetzer, had to talk about it. It was on my mind. However, the one event or the other building that generally gets ignored is the Pentagon. And boy, has the Pentagon generally been ignored through most of it. Because, you know, when we think about September 11th, we almost seldom recall the strangeness and the events that occurred at the Pentagon. you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of talk about how what happened at the Pentagon. Was it a JSAM missile? And let me state this quite clearly. As I do believe that directed energy was probably used on the World Trade Center and the entire complex itself, I do not believe that directed energy was used at the Pentagon. I believe the Pentagon was subject to more conventional means. It makes a lot more sense that a newly renovated wedge of the building would blow up. That seems so much more likely to me. And there's a woman that I do really like, and I appreciate her analysis of the Pentagon. And I don't know how many people are aware of her. I know that she's written several books, one of them being the Toronto Report. And her name was Barbara Honegger. Now, she is a political woman. She has been on the cabinet of Ronald Reagan, and she has quite a bit of political clout. She's been around this area for a long time. You know, I guess maybe you might say a parallel might kind of be like Cynthia McKinney, how she was quite critical of Donald Rumsfeld and the missing $2.3 trillion. However, Barbara Honegger claims that the $2.3 trillion that were missing was closer to $5 trillion. She says it was much closer to $5 trillion. However, I guess I suppose what I'm saying is I know that it's very easy to be critical of people who are in politics. However, I don't believe everyone in politics is wrong. Or, I mean, I don't believe that they're all corrupt or evil people. I do believe that honest people find themselves in these positions. I guess I'm saying is I know that there's a conspiracy of people, and I know that wherever there's power, there is corruption, but not everyone there is bad. And I believe Barbara Honegger is a very legit woman. I don't believe she's trying to mislead anyone. I think she simply saw a problem and she's trying to analyze it or deconstruct it as best she could. She eventually allied herself with people like Stephen Jones and the Architects for Truth and Engineer. Just because I think they're fraudulent, I believe that there were completely honest people that were a part of it. However, Barbara Honegger's analysis of the Pentagon was quite fascinating, one of the best I had ever seen, where Barbara's arguments for the Pentagon on why she believes it was not an airplane that hit the Pentagon. She does not believe that Flight 77, if there ever was a Flight 77, was the device used to hit the Pentagon, because she pulls up two very interesting facts, which is one, the size of the airplane in connection to where it hit, and also the time of impact, which she exposes that there is a time discrepancy in which the official event occurred and when the first explosion happened, because she outlines that there were many explosions that took place at the Pentagon, and she exposed this very, very well in her documentary, or in her presentation, which I believe was called Behind the Smokescreen. For those of you who are interested, it was a great presentation. Like I said, I don't believe in the controlled, Barbara Honegger believes in controlled demolition. I don't, but I simply am looking at her analysis of the Pentagon, and it was fantastic. I believe she hit the nail on the hammer with that one. Oh, and by the way, you probably realize that I've mentioned two very important women that I think, two of the most important women that have, people or women that have analyzed this event. And I just want to say to everyone, to me, women have been the most influential forces in my life, not just Judy Wood or Barbara Honegger. There's been lots of women that have been very influential to me. And I simply wish to state that I don't understand why there would be any group or any movement of people that would want to exclude women from participation. That's absolutely ridiculous. I don't know why anyone would want to do such a thing. You know, I guess this maybe this idea. Now I'm spinning off, but hey, this is what I do. you know, I don't know what this idea is. You know, you got these people out there that think that, you know, that, that women should just mind their own business. They have to, you know, the more traditional idea that women have to stick to the kitchen or whatever, or they should not behave in politics. But let me tell you, women are just as capable as being fanatical as men, if not more so. Women are incredibly powerful and they're incredibly useful in any group or movement. I don't know why there's this stereotype that, that women are these, you know, leftist communists that support multiculturalism like some groups like to maintain. Well, if you just think about that in its own sense, that type of argument, you would realize that women in that sphere are quite fanatical, which is the proof that women can very much be fanatical, just as much as men, like I said, if not more so, in their convictions. What I'm saying is we should never be the kinds of people to exclude women from any participation. Their roles are very important. They've been very influential to my life, and I think in secret they've been very influential to most of our lives. Okay, so a couple notes here about Barbara Honegger and one of her analysis of Flight 77 and the problem that she had with Wedge One. Oh, and by the way, if you're really into the Zionist aspect of 9/11, then you like Barbara Honegger as well, because she likes to talk about the Zionist conspiracies, or rather the Zionist participation in it. Like I said, she's a smart lady. She's pretty good. I like her. So, as we know, allegedly Wedge One, which is the corner, because each wedge of the Pentagon is a corner. It's not actually the flat face. It's the corner. Wedge One was nearly renovated to withstand terrorist attacks, right? So how convenient was it that it would be the one that was hit, allegedly? It's the one that was hit by the so-called terrorist or so-called airplane. Very, very convenient, unless it was, you know, rigged with explosives and it was designed to blow up and they were going to blame it on other people, which is the most likely one. So jotting this down from Barbara Honegger, we have Wedge One was hit by Flight 77, which was a Boeing 757, on the west face. Now, she points out that the west face has a heliport and a ATC tower and firehouse on the west face of the Pentagon, which is very important because that firehouse slash ATC tower was populated. There were firemen stationed there. There were two firemen that were at that position, and they saw what happened. Because they are eyewitnesses, and she does use them to confirm that the official story is bunk, and what we were told is not true. So she said, based on the interior damage, which was 90-95% on the first floor or the ground floor of the Pentagon, that's where most of the damage was, on the ground floor, not the second floor, the ground floor, first floor. 90-95% of the damage. And this was by the building performance report. And so we have the issue now is most of the damage of the Pentagon was done on the base floor, and they claim it was by the airplane that hit it. So this was but the problem that we have here with the airplane is that the top of the fuselage, or rather that the damage was caused by the base of the fuselage, and that it is more than 20 feet above the ground. Or rather, that's where the first floor is. The first floor is about 20 feet above the ground. That was the first base floor. However, as Barbara points out, that the 747's fuselage is 12 feet 4 inches in diameter. That would mean that there would leave less than 8 feet between the bottom of the aircraft and ground level, the dirt. Less than 8 feet. Because remember, most of the damage was caused on the first floor, which is 20 feet. So that means from the fuselage to the ground, there is a difference of 8 feet. However, the huge engines extend 9 feet below or beneath the bottom of the wings. So from the fuselage to the wings, we have now over 20 inches from the engines to the top of the fuselage. We have a little over 21 inches, and allegedly the first floor was 20 inches above the ground. So in order for the model, as she believes, to make sense, in order for the aircraft to have hit the bottom of the Pentagon, the engines of the aircraft must have collided with the ground, which she points out that there was zero evidence in any of the photographs that there was dip marks or scoop marks of the engines of the airplane colliding with the ground, which that is a huge discrepancy. Now, she does point out the fact that there was a lot of damage and that there was, in fact, debris at the Pentagon. But from the eyewitnesses that were present at the Pentagon and at the firehouse, and by other eyewitnesses, that there was an object that flew towards the Pentagon, but it was a white-looking small aircraft. And she concludes from various eyewitnesses that this was a very fairly consistent claim that there was an object that didn't, in fact, fly towards the Pentagon with a white body, which cannot be a 747 because they have a chrome body. You know, it's a shiny aluminum aircraft. To which it's very easy for Barbara Honegger to point out that this very likely was a drone. Mm-hmm. She believes that the object in question that collided or that did hit the Pentagon was a drone. Now, that's a very common argument that people have claimed, that maybe there were drones that hit the towers, then maybe something else happened. I'm not entirely certain, but this does fit in with the Zionist perspective, because the number one manufacturer or designer of drones, I believe, was a Israeli-based company, or it was a, or the one of the CEOs was a half was a Israeli-American dual citizen. Drones were very important. I believe that drones were going to be utilized. Well, they have been utilized. They've been further developed, and now they're going to start using these drones to spy on everyone now. But actually, if you think about drones, aren't drones? Doesn't that just reek of something Jewish? To me, it does. I think drones sound very, it's like chicken shit. You have these drones flying over the air. You're safe. You're never going to get injured. And you can rain hell down on your enemies below. If there was anyone who wanted to fully utilize drones to oppress people, to commit warfare, it would be the Israelis. No doubt in my mind, it would be the Israelis. So yes, so from Barbara Honegger's accounts and from the eyewitnesses she claims that she has collected, there was in fact an aircraft or something that hit. And it is confirmed. There is something that did fly and hit the Pentagon, because we have the footage that was revealed that shows something flying towards the Pentagon and it hit it. It's just that Barbara believes it was a drone. Now, even more interestingly enough, Barbara Honegger believes that this drone was probably damaged by a helicopter that was by SEALs. I think it was a Marines. I think it was a Marine helicopter that was landed at the helipad at the time, but it had actually picked up just before the object had collided with the Pentagon, because she cross-references this with radar reports of objects that were flying in the air, and she confirms that there was a Marine helicopter that had been relocated to the Pentagon and had dipped below the radar level, and then had reemerged in the radar 3 seconds before impact. It's very, very interesting stuff. She brings up a lot of very fascinating information that I couldn't possibly remember, and all my crappy notes are a little bit too sporadic to explain it in greater detail. But in general, her belief was that there was an object that was detected coming towards it, and that the Marines jumped into their helicopter and actually damaged whatever was flying towards the Pentagon, and that's why it was actually smoking. You'll see that in the footage. You can see a weird smoking pattern, which many people still believe it's a JSAM, but Barbara Honegger believes that it was actually a drone. Now, the other interesting fact or interesting part about her theory is that she knows that the plane story of Flight 77 is absolutely incorrect because there's a discrepancy in time. Because what she found was that this drone or whatever it was that had impacted or came close to impacting the Pentagon that exploded actually damaged the firehouse a little bit, which the firehouse was right next to the near impact zone, which is next to the helipad. Hope I'm trying to create a mental image for you. But what happened was the firehouse clock actually stopped. It had got damaged to the point where the firehouse clock actually stopped, and the time at which the firehouse clock ended or broke was at around 5:32, I believe. Around 5:32. Is that what I wrote down? Which is about 5 minutes. Ah, here it is. The clock from the heliport firehouse stopped at 5:32:30, which this clock was displayed at the Smithsonian 9/11 exhibit. However, the official time of impact was 9:38. She's referencing this as the discrepancy in time. There's nearly a 5 minute time difference. So from this, she believes that this is absolute evidence that the official story doesn't make sense. Now, I suppose one could argue that, well, what if the firehouse clock was just off? The time was actually just 5 minutes slow or something like that. One could definitely make that argument that maybe it did, the actual event did, the alleged Flight 77 did actually impact at 9:38. However, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense because at a military base, we would assume that the clocks must be synchronized because everything is you know, everything has to be precise. Why would you have this one clock within the fire station that's 5 minutes slow? Which is weird. She also cross-references this with another eyewitness whose wristwatch stopped working after the first alleged impact, and her watch stopped at 5:30. And her name was... name somewhere around here. April Gallops. April Gallops. That was her name. She was a black lady that worked at the Pentagon, and she was working on the west face near Wedge 1, where the initial impact occurred, and her wristwatch stopped working at 9:30. Now, in that instance, I will get to your questions in just a moment in the chat. I do see it. Now, she does concede that maybe her wristwatch was a little slow, maybe a couple minutes slow on April Gallop. However, she does note it, but she does note very specifically that her wristwatch stopped working at 9:30 after the first impact. We have a question asked, how do you spell Barbara's last name? Her last name is Honegger, which is H-O-N-E-G-G-E-R. H-O-N-E-G-G-E-R, Barbara Honegger. Yep. There you go. Thank you, Shauna C. In fact, Barbara Honegger created a timeline of a series of explosions and events that occurred at the Pentagon, in which she concludes that there was at least 5 or 6, possibly even 7 reports of explosions occurring at the Pentagon from just one airplane. The first one starting with April Gallop at around 9:30 with her wristwatch stopping in her testimony. She suspected that's probably one. She notes that at 9:31:40, the Navy area clock stopped functioning. That was inside the Pentagon, and that was in the D wing, which is the outer ring of the Pentagon. So at 9:31:40, there seems to have been some sort of action or explosion which caused that stop to stop functioning. Well, of course, at 9:32:30, the firehouse clock stopped working. How strange. And of course, she says at 9:34:10, there was another odd explosion, an explosion of black smoke that was seen in one of the security cameras. At 9:43, there was a photograph of a weird fireball. She calls it a weird fireball explosion, which occurred, which Lieutenant Kevin Schaefer witnessed, or he was present. She also says at 9:48, there was another explosion allegedly reported. And I do know that at 10:10, Fox 5, Fox News Channel 5, at 10:10 reported that there was another explosion that occurred at the Pentagon. I guess what I'm saying is there was a lot of weird stuff going on at the Pentagon, which is hardly consistent with the official story. Now, Barbara Honegger, interestingly enough, because of her long history in government, she states that the Pentagon was important because that the Pentagon was the prelude to war. She says the Twin Towers alone wasn't enough to start a war. Those were just, as she said, those were simply civilian buildings. However, the Pentagon was a government military building, and so its attack, or that building being attacked, opened the door for politicians to attack and invade other countries. And I would argue that is the significance of the Pentagon. I think maybe we focus a little bit too much on the Twin Towers, but she's absolutely correct on that. The Twin Towers were civilian buildings, but the Pentagon sealed the deal. That one getting attacked, allegedly, is what allowed for all these wars to occur. So I sense a conspiracy with that. I mean, how convenient, right, that the alleged terrorist would happen to also hit the Pentagon, a government military building. You'll probably notice that I haven't mentioned anything about Lucky Larry Silverstein, as I am fully aware of Larry Silverstein. However, I just kind of think that he's not a very important person. Yes, obviously, there's insider knowledge. He didn't arrive on work at time. Neither did his children. I don't believe in coincidences. However, I just don't think Larry was really involved in it. I just kind of see him as a middleman, as a leaseholder. I mean, I would love to interview him. I would love to know more about what Larry may have known, but there's a good chance that Larry may not have known a whole lot. But then again, there's a lot of people that had insider knowledge that didn't necessarily get in trouble. You can also recall who's that awful cartoonist? Awful cartoonist who does Family Guy, Cleveland Show. God damn, what's his name? You see, that's how insignificant he is to me. I really don't care for this guy. His cartoons are awful. But allegedly, he was supposed to be on one of the flights that gets hijacked. Now, like I said, I don't know what happened to the airplanes. I'm not ruling out the possibility that the flights really did exist. I simply just don't know. I am not certain of it. I just don't think the airplane, if the airplanes were real, I just don't think they were used to crash in the towers. I simply just don't know. But there were plenty of people that walked away just fine. Yeah. Lucky Larry's dermatology appointment. His very convenient dermatology appointment that he apparently didn't want to take, but his wife told him to do it. And he's going to listen to his wife because his wife told him. Yeah, there's all sorts of shenanigans were afoot that day, and we're simply just told to believe it. We're just told to go along with the official story. All sorts of ridiculousness, and of course, I mean, there's so much more. I mean, like, you can look at the Rockefellers and the role they played in the construction of the World Trade Towers, how they implemented eminent domain to acquire that land, and then how David and Nelson Rockefeller worked together to build it. And then we can look at memoirs and the books Divided We Stand and the weird foreshadowing even within those books, that those towers are going to disappear. I believe in Divided We Stand, the book Divided We Stand, I believe that there's a person who said that the towers had a built-in disappearing act. How strange is that? Maybe they really did. At least I think they did. Oh, and as a side note, so a lot of people think that the, or some people think that the Rockefellers are not Jews. And I will say, I don't know if the Rockefellers are or are not Jews. I really don't know. They could be cryptos. I do know that in the when I was looking into the family lineage of the Rockefellers, I did find that some of their ancestors did marry Jews, some of the more recent ones. But were they Jews? I don't know. However, some people kind of think that maybe the Rockefellers represent Gothics. Yeah, Rockefellers and Rothschilds. You know, I'm not going to get into it. It's not too important. What I was about to mention. It's a little bit of an odd one, but it's not. You know, I have 20 minutes left. I've bloviated enough. I probably sound pretty incoherent. But let me get to the stuff that is really strange, which fits into astrotheology and which delves a little bit into the occult aspects of September 11th, because September 11th wasn't just an attack on two physical towers. It was an attack on our minds. This was an assault on our reality. That's what this was. Like, okay, so here's an example. Remember I was talking about astrotheology and how I believe it's the basis of everything. I absolutely believe it's true, because the hermetic principles of as above, so below apply directly to the stars. They're talking about Earth. They're talking about the planets. They're talking about constellations. That is the big secret that these guys follow. And it's by no coincidence that these people don't want you to pay attention to this stuff, because to them it has real power. Now, I don't know whether it has real power or it doesn't. I am not certain, but they seem to think it does. They seem to think it has real power. So how about this one, which I was able to confirm with the, what's this website called? It's called Astrograph. Astrograph on September 11th, 2001. And there was actually a very strange alignment of the planets on that day. Fancy this one. This is what I mean. These guys had this well thought out way in advance. This was not a spur of the moment event. Despite what anyone tells you, this was well considered. So on September 11th, 2001, the planet Saturn was in the constellation of Gemini. And where we have the planet of Pluto was in the constellation of Sagittarius. And I say this because Pluto and Saturn were aligned with Earth. They formed a straight line straight across, and that's one of the alignments that they had. Now, Saturn is equated towards materialistic power, form, and structure. That's what Saturn can represent. But it was in the constellation of Gemini, which Gemini stands for twins or multiplicity, which very much seems eerily reminiscent towards the twin towers. Two towers, Gemini, multiplicity. However, Earth and Saturn were also aligned with Pluto, which was in the constellation of Sagittarius. And Pluto stands for destruction and transformation, while Sagittarius stands for religion, foreign cultures, and long-distance travel. Now, I understand that some of you are probably thinking, well, is Pluto really significant? Because for the longest times, we believe that there were seven planets in the sky, all the way up to Saturn. And what about Neptune, Uranus, and Pluto? Are these even real planets? I've questioned that myself, if they're even real, because we can't see them with the naked eye. And although I have wrestled with that issue, there's a very real chance that they could be real, just by the research that I looked into. And the history of Pluto is absolutely is absolutely fascinating. Okay, quick question. Does Bill practice astrology? No, I don't. I don't because I simply just don't know enough. Oh, another question. Did any Jews die on September 11th? I don't think so. Some claim some Jews died on September 11th. I don't think so. I don't believe any Jews died. But let me just put it this way. The history of Pluto is very unusual. How Pluto got its name is unusual. There's an official story of how it was named, but there's also the alternative story of how it was named, which I think is a little bit more likely. I'm not going to get into it. It's strange. Maybe for another time. However, we have these two alignments. Again, Pluto, Saturn, Gemini, Sagittarius. And I think this is amplifying the power of the destruction of the twin towers. Materialistic power, structure and form, twins, multiplicity, destruction, transformation through Pluto and Sagittarius, talking about religion and cultures. This looks like it's fitting in perfectly with some sort of occult practice. Now, as towards Saturn, there is a lot of Saturn symbology in the Twin Towers and the World Trade Center complex itself. Now, you understand, I've said this before, I am totally fascinated by the Saturn Black Cube conspiracy. I believe that there is a cult of Black Saturn worshippers and Jews are Saturn worshippers. Jews became Saturn worshippers with the prophet of Sabbatai Si, which literally means Saturn. I believe that Jews historically have been weird cult worshippers of other groups. But with the prophet of Sabbatai Si, I think they became Saturn worshippers. So here's some strange coincidences with Saturn and the World Trade Center complex. Saturn's rings are made up of seven parts. There were seven buildings in the World Trade Center complex. Saturn is represented by the Seal of Solomon, which of course is the what we call the Star of David, which is two triangles, which represents the as above, so below concept. However, we have the Solomon Towers. I didn't write that note too well. I said Solomon's Towers. I think that has something. Oh yeah, that's right. Solomon Towers. That's towards the Temple of Solomon, the Seal of Solomon and Solomon's Towers, the Temple of Solomon, the two pillars. Now the engineer who designed the Twin Towers was a Japanese guy, and forgive me, I forgot his name. But he was a Japanese guy, and he was inspired he was inspired by the Kaaba at Mecca. By the Kaaba at Mecca, there's two pillars at the Kaaba at Mecca, which inspired this Japanese engineer to allegedly inspired him to construct the Twin Towers. And of course, at the Kaaba is a black cube, which again is a reference to the black cube of Saturn, where all the Arabs form rings around Saturn, around the black cube, the Kaaba. And they walk around it. Again, this is Saturn symbology, and a lot of Arabs are blissfully unaware that the Kaaba is a Saturn reference, is a reference towards Saturn. Also, it's also a little bit strange that you go to the Kaaba to worship Allah, Kaaba Allah, Kabbalah. Is there something with that? I don't know. Go to the Kaaba to worship Allah. All right. So there's something. So again, there's another connection there with black cubes of Saturn. Now, in the mid, let's see, Saturn was aligned in Gemini in 1973. Saturn was aligned with Gemini in the same position that it was in September 11th, and it was in 1973 when the Twin Towers were officially opened. They weren't complete. They were already complete. They were completed like 2 years before that point or so. But the ceremony when it was officially opened happened in in 1973, which again, Saturn was aligned with Gemini in 1973. And how strange would it be that Saturn was again aligned with Gemini on September 11th? It was in the same position in space when the towers were officially opened and when the towers were destroyed. Now, Saturn is often referred to as the gateway to the gods, the planet of Saturn, and it's heavily referenced in Freemasonry, in Kabbalah, in tarot, in many occult fields that have been heavily influenced by Judaism, I believe. Maybe there's a connection in there with Egypt somewhere, but in our modern day esotericism, Saturn has a very unique position. But again, Saturn is referenced towards the gateway of the gods, and it can be represented by the two pillars, which in Freemasonry, the two pillars are Boaz and Jankin. Okay? There is Boaz and Jankin, which also is a direct reference towards the Kabbalistic tree of life, the two pillars, the left-hand path and the right-hand path as well. There's another reference to it in tarot, I believe. But point being, there is a very, very Saturn connection to all of this. It's very strange, and it's very fascinating. Now, there's also some other interesting concepts with the towers as well. As I think, in some respect, in another aspect, no, I would like to talk more about the astrotheology part. It's just that I didn't have enough time to jot down enough notes, but I would like to talk more because there's more I can talk about. It's just I just don't have enough notes. However, another aspect of 9/11 which I find fascinating is that there is a reference to it, or I believe in one of my interpretations, that September 11th looks like it is a symbolic recreation of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. That's right. Now, I'm not saying that the Jews love Jesus. On the contrary. However, it's fascinating to note that the Twin Towers stood for 33 years, which allegedly Jesus Christ lived for 33 years. And there are other people that believe that Jesus was born on September 11th. Some believe that he did. And because I believe everything about September 11th was pre-planned or orchestrated, I think everything has meaning to it. And so when I see the airplane come in and hit the tower, and it hit the mail tower. Remember, it's the tower with the antenna, which most people just think, oh, it's just an antenna. Actually, I see it as a phallus. That's actually what I see it as. So it indicates that it is a male tower. The airplane flew in at a bank, like the Spear of Langness, and punctured into the tower. And of course, as dramatic as it was, despite the fact that the North Tower was hit first, it was also the second tower to fall. It creates for a more dramatic effect, in my opinion, if you were to perform things that way. Excuse me. But everything about 9/11 was filmed like a movie. It's absolute, and to me, the cinematography of it is absolutely fascinating. Like, compare it. When you watch the September 11 news footages or whatnot, pay attention to how it's filmed. Isn't it odd that there isn't any cameras that are focusing in on the alleged airplanes that hit the tower? Instead, all the cameras are focused in on the tower, but what you see happens is that just before impact, or just as impact occurs, where we see the explosion, there's a zoom in, The camera focuses in and zooms in on the tower, which creates intensity. This is a cinematography trick to create emotion. It creates tension because everything you see on television is to gain, is to manipulate your emotions and your feelings. And that's partially what cinema or the psychology of cinema have done. I think the Jews have learned a lot from cinema, learning, you know, mastering their techniques of cinematography to gain access to people's emotions. Because when you have someone by the emotions, it doesn't matter what they think. Emotions override knowledge. They override logic. And so cinema is a great tool for that. And tricks of cinematography were most certainly used on September 11th because it was filmed like a movie. It was filmed like a documentary, and it is specifically designed to gain emotions from you. Oh, and of course, we always know when these actions or when these people perform their actions because they love making monuments to everything that they do. Just like when they perform the Holocaust, just like the Twin Towers. Wherever those are their fingerprints. They leave those behind so that you know. Because what they are doing is they built it, they designed it, they destroyed it, and it is your job to remember it. They want you to mourn over their creations. They want that for you. And so, of course, now we have the memorials of the World Trade Centers, which are also, believe it or not, they look like giant toilets, by the way. But what they are actually are black cubes. You have these black recessed cubes into the earth. And more than that, it's a cube within a cube. It's a hypercube. The memorial is literally a hypercube, a cube within a cube, which represents the as above, so below concept. So it is just so fascinating. To me, it's both. It's fascinating, it's creepy, it's occult. It's just, there's so many angles in which you can examine September 11th. And just when you think you understand one thing, if you just stand on a slightly different position, you'll see an entirely different angle from it. It's absolutely absurd, and that's what I mean. I mean, I've just grazed over this information. It's so much. There's so much more that you can analyze about September 11th, and for that, to me, it is just fascinating. But like I said, when I first picked up on this stuff, I was very bothered, very concerned, very. And to an extent, I was frightened. I did lose sleep at night. But fear, but knowledge eventually gives way. Fear gives way to knowledge, and once you understand, things no longer bother you as much. You become a little bit more fascinated by just the methodology and the knowledge and tricks behind it. I'd also like to mention, I see Circus Maximus. Hey, it's Nick Spiro, and he's in the chat. This is fantastic. I want to say, hey, Nick Spiro, I hope everything's going well. It was a real disappointment to have you for your hiatus. We'll call it a hiatus from Renegade Broadcasting. I hope everything in your life is going well, Nick. And I hope eventually things get under control, and I hope eventually you have a show back on Renegade Broadcasting. It would be very fun. You are awesome, man. Thank you. Sorry everyone. I have to take this time because I wanted to talk to Nick Spiro, but just as I started coming around, Nick kind of left, and it was very disappointing, and I always wanted to throw some good words in for him. So, and I see he's in the chat, so I just want to throw that out there. Yes. Thank you, Nick. You were very inspirational, and it was actually your leaving that was part of the inspiration for me to try to step up my game a little bit and try and help out Renegade Broadcasting a bit. So it's real pleasure. And I wish you the best, Nick. I hope everything is going by okay. I hope you get things resolved. So I guess in conclusion, I apologize. This wasn't my best show. I understand that. It was a little bit of too much ranting and a little too incoherent. But you know, you're always your worst critic. You know. You are your own worst critic, and you're always very, very disappointed in what you can do. Thank you, Level 6 Toaster. That was a nice compliment. I would like to think I'm a natural. Maybe it was just because I haven't been doing a whole lot. Because you know what? Here's another thing for you all. I've been really trying to get back into shape. Hey, thank you very much, Alabama White Devil. But here's one for you. I've been trying to get back into shape. I've been, you know, as you know, I like to go out for walks a lot, but I've been ignoring my upper body a lot. And so in the afternoons, I've been trying to, you know, I've been working out, trying to rebuild some confidence, because let me tell you, when you get back into shape, you regain that confidence. Being healthy is very important. And I was never out of shape, but I've been neglecting myself for a while. You know, I've been distracted, I've been busy. So I've been trying to allocate more time to living a little bit healthier. So that's actually what's been, you know, eating up some of my time, because, you know, you have to set that time up in the afternoons to do it. I apologize. My throat's getting a little dry. I've been rambling on for 2 hours. Oh. But you know, when you're healthy, you feel better, you feel more confident, and you're confident in yourself. And that is for everyone. Absolutely. Well, I think my 2 hours are up. I hope I wasn't too annoying. I hope I got enough information out there. Right, thank you very much. We'll see you all next week. And next week I will be talking about the homosexual agenda. Last week I said I would, but I just forgot about time, and I said, oh my God, it's September 11th already. I have to talk about this. So next week, the homosexual agenda. Stay tuned, everyone.
Did you have a friend on the Liberty? I had a friend on the Liberty. They tried to sink her to the bottom of the sea. She kept on floating into history. Unmarked jets flew down from the sky and shot up our ship, and nobody knew why. A torpedo boat blew a hole in her side. A lot of sailors hurt, and 34 died. Come to find out it was part of a plan. They'd sink our ship, she'd go down with all hands. Blame it on Egypt to trick us in a war. The trick didn't work, the crew showed them what's for. Did you have a friend on the Liberty? I had a friend on the Liberty. Who tried to sink her? It was Israelis. But she kept on floating into history. Oh, LBJ was the president who told us all it was an accident. And now he got traitors like John McCain, whose daddy was a man who covered up the shame. Oh, John McCain, if you have a friend on the Liberty. I had a friend on the Liberty who tried to sink her, it was Israelis. She kept on floating into history. Did you have a friend on the Liberty? I had a friend on the Liberty. They tried to sink her, those Israelis. She kept on floating into history. Liberty.
prizes.